Let's just get a level, so give me your name again.
Guy Livingston.
Perfect. And let's see, it's March 4th, is it? 19?
I don't, 4th or 5th. What's the day, the 4th or 5th?
Doesn't matter.
5th, I think.
I have no idea.
See, Thursday the 5th, yeah.
Okay.
Well, Friday told about the John Q lived over, I think, on the Q Vassar Road. And I think that's why they call it Mary Q Place now. And, of course, they have something to eat at night sometimes, and they drink milk or cider or something. And the old man took a jug, went downstairs to get a pitcher of cider. He had much more and closed the door and heard a thump. His wife heard a thumping and banging. And she run to the door and she says, "What happened?" He says, "I fell down the stairs." She said, "You break mother's pitcher?" He says, "No, by God, but I will." And he threw it against the cellar wall.
Same kind of. That's terrific.
And I tell you about the woman that, she lived over here in South Facing. And back in the, about the early 1900s or late 1800s, a lot of women would do the work and then work out in fields, especially in harvest time. And this woman walked from South Facing over north and working in the fields. And sometime in the middle of the day, she and some of the women that was working with her went over behind some bushes and staged the field. She delivered a baby. And when she got the baby all set, she went back and finished work in the fields. Then the day she picked the baby up and walked back South Facing. Distance about 12 miles. And I think my father told me the name one time, but I've forgotten.
Incredible, isn't it?
I mean, that's around somewhere around 1900.
Imagine that.
But she finished up the day and carried the baby back. And and then there's a fellow lived up across here. I mentioned about it. He come down maybe once, twice a year to spend all day. Well, first time he had ice cream at a party, we gave him some, and he'd never had it before, never knew what it was. I mean, she'd eaten it. Of course, there's Irish, quite a lot of Scotch Irish around here then. And somebody come up to him, she says, "Say, John," says, "how'd you like that ice cream?" "Oh," he says, "mighty good, but a damn cold."
And who was that guy again?
John McComb.
John McComb?
McComb, N, I think it was N.
And the Q people, I've heard them mentioned a number of times. Is that C-U-E or is it
K-E-W.
K-E-W, Q, okay.
Yeah, let's see. Oh, yeah, and then there's a McKay's. At one time, they lived down here, first place coming up the hill. Mm-hmm. There's a cellar hole still there. Then they went out to Montpelier around and they bought the Pavilion Farm. And that was, as you go into Montpelier, and there's a Callahan, has a veterinary service right there. That was the original house. And then across the road uphill, the way is where the barn was. And that Pavilion Farm used to furnish the milk and all that for the hotel. And this old couple had it, and they really had a Irish brogue, and I hardly understand them. So my folks brought them out one time to visit when we lived in Montpelier, and they stopped at Carlong's store at the middle of the village there where the paint store was, and we didn't get them all of us an ice cream cone. I was sitting between them, the old folks in the back, and the old man ate the cone down at the top of the cone and took his finger, scooped the rest out. He said, "You think we had to furnish spoons with this?" His wife said, "Well, John, you're supposed to eat the cone too."
That's like the banana story. What's that one where the guy, he has never had a banana before. And so he eats the skin and throws away the banana. And they ask him, "John, how did you like the banana?" And he said, Well, the skin's a little tough, and there's an awful lot of core. I threw that away.
That's about the way I heard about an orange on it. The orange, but they peel and all, and they eat the orange. It's just the way you would an apple. Well, I worked for Andy Barrett Sr. for a number of years down the mill, and he told me about working steeplejack. Did I mention that to you?
No.
Well, he worked for one summer for he's an older fellow. These are all young fellows that worked for him in the early 20s or something. The old fellow's up probably in his late 40s, early 50s, along in there. I think his name was Childs. Anyhow, yeah, I'm pretty sure he lived in the White House by the what they call a country store there in the Duxbury Hills. And just past that, it's a big house. And so Andy and Mark Seaver and I have to look up the other fellow's name.
He's really good.
And Fred Wilder. Yeah. I asked Sterling about that. Worked for him. And they got a job down in Massachusetts of painting and repairing a water tower at a mental hospital. Well, had to replace some roofs up there, so they had a couple of fellows up on top of the tower, and the rivet busted, they call it. It was something like a spitting ball. They'd hold that, one fellow hold that against the rivet, and the other would hit it with a sledgehammer. Well, the fellow swung his sledgehammer, missed the maul, hit the handle, it broke, and it dropped, hit the cement base, bounced up into the air about 10, 12 feet. When it come down that time, hit the old man on top of the head. And so he grabbed his head and was staggering around, you know. About time he got recovering a little bit, Mark Seaver got to him. And the old man used some pretty strong language about the idiot that dropped that thing from the tower. And Mark told him, he says, well, he says, if he dropped from the top of the tower, he says, the next thing. He says, if he dropped from the top of the tower, he says, you'd be around to use the language you're using. He got the old man, carried him down, the blood run down his bald-headed, down off his head and off his nose. So Mark had a full-time nurse dispensary there for the patients. So Mark talked to the old man and going down there. And he got him going down, and before they got there, the nurse looked up and saw him coming. So just they got the door, she opened the screen door and she says, bring the patient right on in. Well, the old man yelled, I'm not a patient. And he says, tell her, Mark, that I'm not a patient. Mark, of course, he was kind of a jokester anyway, prankster anyway. He says he's not a patient. And he kept letting on like he was just favored to a fellow, you know. So he says, oh, no, well, you're not a patient. He says, well, I am not a patient. He says, tell her, Mark, I'm not a patient. Well, Mark says he's not a patient. And he kept that up for a few minutes. They finally, the nurses decided that he really wasn't one of the mental health patients. Got him in his head managed. And then he worked at the, started in as a cookie, helping the cook.
Uh-huh.
At one of the logging camps up here. And the cook was well known all over for being the best lumber camp cook around. And in fact, I read a book coming over from overseas. I had to pick it up, something new. And the name of it was Burning Empire and by Stuart Holbrook.
Yeah.
And it covered all the logging drives and everything, clear from the East Coast and that to Oregon. That's where he died some years ago. And he mentioned his cook, told him about it, and I'd forgotten all about it till one day Andy was telling me about working for this cook, how I always wore a white shirt and a bow tie and that. When I got the, Andy said he had a job of doing all the running, you know. He said one thing he had to do was go down into the storeroom and get the filling for pies and that. He said, boy, he said, after you did it a while, he said, you couldn't stand it. He says, it'd make you almost sick just to get that stuff. But he said, this cook would make quite a lot of pies. They get new lumberjacks, so in and they'd sit there and he'd come in with the pies, they'd drop everything else, grab and go for the pies. And the cook see it and he says, you fellas like pies? So I said, yes, Phil. He said, we got some more to go out and bring in all they wanted. And after a few days, they'd eat the same as the others and save the pie for dessert. And
imagine wearing a shirt and tie.
Yeah. Is the end? It's always a clean shirt and tie too.
Where? What lumber camp?
Well, they had one right here as you go up by the battleground.
Uh huh.
And they had another one over by Glen Allen, about 2/3 way up the mountain. But I took it away. Andy spoke. It's this one here, and it's back long in the 20s, I guess. And Andy's father had been a tinsmith or something.
Uh huh.
And he worked for Ormsby, I think it was. No, it wasn't Ormsby. There's a place out there in Ontario anyway, Haverhill or Ormsby.
Ormsby?
One of them, and I think it was the other one. And he was working on a metal roof one day and had a sunstroke, and he died after that, and he was about 13 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
And but he said his father, somebody came in with a pewter jug one day, and his father took it. He broke a handle off, took it up, and soldered it, brought it back. He says, you can tell the difference. He said he was the only man he ever knew that could solder pewter back where you couldn't see it.
That's amazing.
But then Andy said he got where he's scaling logs and lumber and that. And when they had new men come in, he said a lot of Pollocks coming in then, and they'd send them up from Boston. They'd come up here to work. They had a recruiting office right down in Boston. And they'd come up here to work. And Woods boss would see what they do. He'd give them an axe, says, go out and cut a tree. And they had a lot of big tall trees right close to camp alongside the road. So he said this one fell out one day and chopped down a tree. Well, a little while later he and Andy happened to be going along, and he said, I spoke to Andy, he said, you want to see what the fellow's doing? Well, he got there and he looked at how the fellow had been chopping. He looked at the tree and stood there about a couple of minutes and said, I'll be damned. The fellow cut round and round the tree, and all that was left was this piece in the middle about the size of a dime. There wasn't a breath of air or anything. And they said they stood there about 5 minutes, and finally the tree fell over, and it was right across the logging road. Of course, they had to cut it out before they could do anything. And then they said they put a young fellow in one day that needed an edger man, run the edger. Well, if you don't know what you're doing, anything in the mill is dangerous, or logging is. And I work in the mill, and I see one of those boards kick back from an edger and hit the sauce and just splinter in the kindling. This fellow, they got him his young pullock to run the boards through. Well, he run one through and it got caught. Well, no one ever told him to keep out of the way. So he stood there and it kicked back and shattered his hip and leg. Of course, that leave him a cripple for life.
Oh my gosh.
And he said they used to... He knew a couple of fellows that went in the woods one fall, stayed all winter, come out in the spring, and never went telling or anything, had $1,000 apiece. That was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
Went out on the town, come back a week later, and ready to go in the woods again, dead broke. And said one old fellow, I can't remember his name, but he went in down to Boston to get a job back, find a job down in the recruiting place. It was on the second floor. They asked him what he was. He said he was a teamster. So they wanted to see if he could handle it, bind the load down and all that. They had a little miniature sled and all, everything went with it. So he bound the logs on and that. And when they got all done, he was just getting sober from going out and spending his pay. He said, and this is the way I go down the mountain. He grabbed the sled and took a run and jumped on it and took belly bump down the flight of stairs. I guess it really destroyed the sled and it didn't help him any either.
Oh, dear. Well, Andy Baird ran the sawmill, right?
Yeah, it used to be the Richardson's Mill across the road where the dam used to be. You'd see the parts of it, and it washed out. I think it was in 45. I wasn't around here when it went out. Then another fellow started to build where the mill is there right after the war, and he left or something, and they took over and built it. Now, that place used to belong to the Richardson brothers, Roy and Clay Richardson.
Because I think at one point, several years ago, I went to see Harry Smith, and he told me that, and I don't know whether it was Andy Baird or not, had been complaining about Gallagher and his cider mill. And
it must have been before that, yeah.
How he watered down his cider, and he said that he would be careful not to run his mill while Gallagher was running his cider mill because he didn't want chips in the cider.
Well, Clarence Gallagher's boy, Bob Gallagher, has a Gallagher's Lumber there in Middlesex. And he and I in the same class at school together.
Is that right?
And after he got in high school, we used to hike to school, you know. And he and Bob and I and a couple of us would stop in and get a dipper of that fresh cider. Before we got home, we used to head into bushes up there where they got the rubbish disposal place now in the professional building. It was all bushes and trees, and that's why we have that. We lived up on Mert Bragg's place, where Merle Johnson is now. And anyway, speaking of that, back in the 30s, Paul Harrison's father, I think his name Clarence, lived up where the Keyhoe Inn is. And Guy Johnson, he and I went to class together too. And his folks lived top of the Dugway where the den is. And his father's name was Harold Johnson. And they had some big old Concord trucks that they used for. Both of them were road commissioners, working on the road in Wakefield and Warren. And along that time, they started experimenting putting plows on. So what they did, they got some big heavy plank and bolted them together in a V-shape and put them on the trucks and bolted them on that way. And they worked to some extent. And I know that one winter, Harold Johnson had one was logging. Well, come up the old road there in the Dugway, where the 1700 meet. And these old Concord trucks would just crawl up about 2 miles an hour. Well, they was coming up with one of his drivers coming up, a big load of logs, just crawled up, just got top of the hill. And Guy Johnson and a fellow named Freeman Miller were sliding on the hand sled, belly mounting, one on top of the other. They come down, well, I guess you call it Vastus Hill now, but it used to be McLaughlin Hill up from the Knoll Farm. They were coming down there, pretty good clip. And they couldn't stop, and they couldn't steer, so they missed that truck. So they shot through just behind the front wheels and out the other side. And the truck was set so high, and neither one got hurt, but I guess the driver pretty near passed out. And I never did get around to ask Guy if he's standing up for a few days or not.
Can you imagine? The things that have happened really are amazing.
You know? I know it. I only hear what some of the kids are doing today.
I remember, I never went out much for Halloween, but when we lived up there by Merritt Bragg's, the churches, Acor and Arthur Church, was up part of their farm was up part of the spring, what is it, Cold Spring Lodges now, up by the airport road, below the freeze. Have a Halloween party and everybody go on cider and apples and stuff like that and donuts and everybody visit, you know. And there's my folks, the Livingstons and the Braggs, the Folsoms and the Irishes and the Freese, maybe the Longs, all go there for that one night. So I didn't get out most of the other, I never went out Halloween night, but I think I must have been about junior in high school. We had a principal named Lindsley, and he lived an apartment house. He still got one across the road from Bonnet's Garage, Wakefield Auto now. He had, about a 33 Ford sedan. And if you locked it up and took keys out, you could lock steering and lock car up too. Well, this Halloween, morning after Halloween, his car was missing. And next afternoon, they found it. It was over where the pole field is now. It was about a year before, Goodyear lived there then in the farm. He lost cow in there. And he was a father-in-law to Clarence Tucker. And cow got in, they had to dig around and get it out. So that's a pretty good hole. So what the boys had done, they got on each side of the car and picked it up, and lugged it over and dropped it down in the hole and then covered it over there in the straw. As the next afternoon, they found it. And Harry Bonnet had a ton Model A truck used for a wrecker. We got him pulled out, and the car wasn't damaged at all. They just stopped it straight in. They tried that new car, and it'd be totaled, you know.
That's amazing. Yeah.
But I never really knew who was that. They kept pretty quiet about that. Of course, most of them are probably still in school.
I would think they would be a little nervous about retaliation.
Yeah. I think that right. That's one thing. I wrote something down. And he said, I think he's about 19. He had a job as working as a helper for a couple of plasterers on a house. All the walls were plastered, of course, in those days. And I believe the house was in Warren. It could have been down in Granville or somewhere, but I think it was up here. And the house had been bought by the daughter of John Deere. She was an old lady, and her father's one that originated the John Deere Equipment Company.
I'll be glad.
And she built the house and going to have it modernized for those days. Some of the walls were a little bit crooked, and so the fellows used plaster to straighten them. Might be out, you know, 2-3 inches. And he said, no matter how hard he and this fellow worked, he said, the pay was pretty good, but he never worked so hard in his life. Would try to get that mixed, the plaster mix, lug it into the plasters. He said, they'd be out mixing another batch, and the plasters would be leaning out the window hollering at them, more mud, more mud, and they were having a big kick out of it.
Yeah, because I think John Deere himself moved out to the Midwest or...
Yeah, he was out Indiana, Illinois, somewhere there. Yeah, that's where he moved out there from the state. But it was his daughter come back and, of course, had money then, and she got this house. And I think he said it more, but I never got pinned down just where it was. But I think he said this where it was. It was around the valley here anyway. Mm. So some of this I'm more or less probably skipped.
Oh, yeah. Don't skip anything.
You know, I might have missed the... I'll look back through and see if I missed one or two of these. Yeah, well, I do, like I said, I write through it and then I mark out and change it over, usually write it over. Especially when I clash with some of these out here in the 7 month figure. And I do once in a while. And, of course, when my folks went out to Toledo, that was in 1926, in the spring. And that Christmas, my grandmother, Lizzie Ann, she lived down in the old hotel, Livingston.
The old hotel in Warren?
Waitsfield,
there on the corner.
And she lived in the first floor there. That she and this Jack Smales, he lost his whole family, I guess, mentioned about TB at that time. And he was his barber, and she kept house for him, and he was Carl Long's father-in-law. And Carl Long's wife and his daughter died of TB. And Carl had a boy, got to be about 12, and lost a finger fooling around the mill. I took him out at the hospital, Heaton Hospital, and I guess they just didn't pay as much attention. Those days, he got blood poisoning and died about 12 years old. Yeah. Carl, I guess, never did get over it. But anyway, she ordered this subscription. It was a Barry Times then, at Times Argus, and Barry Times, and Barry, she ordered a subscription, Barry Times, for my folks and my Uncle Jim. And got Long the next year in 27, and Long for a while, about 2 weeks. Nobody got a paper. And I remember my folks, Uncle Jim said, couldn't figure it out. They said, it'd been coming pretty regular, and they hadn't gotten it. And after about 2-3 weeks, and they hadn't got it, we got one, the Barry Times, as a single sheet of paper, about the size of a single sheet of advertising you'd have for stores and stuff now. It's probably 16, 18 inches wide and probably about 20 inches high. Printed on both sides, telling about what happened back here. It was a 27 flood, and it's the first we knew about it. It was 2 weeks after they did it here.
Oh my gosh.
That's the first that any of us knew out there in Toledo, so you'd figure out how fast the news traveled in those days.
Yeah, that is amazing, isn't it?
That's in 27. Yeah, and my mother, I think, had a second cousin The last, she heard the last he'd ever been seen was riding on a ridgepole of a barn floating down the Winooski River just above the dam below Waterbury. Mm. And I don't believe his body ever was found. And my grandmother, the Wakesfield here, was pretty well shut off. And I guess the only way he got out was on foot or horseback or something, because everything was washed so. And they didn't, people did a lot of cooking, but they ended up with no yeast to cook with. So my grandmother showed them how to make potato yeast so they could make their bread and stuff. And she was well known all over the Wakesfield for her donuts. And I never knew her make a greasy one that, and it's always, they were always good. And I think that I found out how she, why she, it was, because I was down there one time, and she said something about getting the lard hot enough. I said, how do you know, or something. She said, like this. So she took one of these diamond matches, blue head, I guess call them, and stuck it on the lard, and said, not ready yet. A few minutes later, she didn't touch it, and that light the match. When it lit the match, the lard is hot enough to fry the donuts in.
I'll be darned. Isn't that interesting? How did she make the potato yeast?
I don't know. But she was the only one around that knew it. She had, of course, she's Scotch-Irish, or I guess Welsh-Irish. I think her, I'm not sure, but I believe her mother's was a Macintosh or something. I think from Wales or some such thing. She was born over just above Easty Long upon Old Tucker Hill, across the road from him up there, an old, they used to call it the Emerson place. And she was born out, 1850, somewhere in there, or something like that.
So at that point, it sounds like there were a lot of Irish.
Oh, yeah, it was all through here. And in fact, when I was in high school, we had a teacher, and she claimed it, and I guess I read it somewhere, that Vermont was the most Anglo-Saxon state for any state in, well, in New England anyway. The only other place would be down the Alleghenies, I guess.
Yeah.
But the, and Andy Baird used to tell about the, I guess I mentioned how they'd come in, somebody'd bring a cow down, ask them to keep the cow, if they want to keep the cow for winter, they'd have them out. And if it's fresh, they'd have a calf in the spring, and that's the way, that, you know, as long as they get some, somebody bring some chickens down, and somebody else bring a pig or something, or say a runt pig or something, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but that's how they get started.
That's a generous community.
And my father, he mentioned one time about, well, before they had too many cars, he'd got a new buggy and a white harness. He had a black horse. And that, the whole thing, he got all fixed up. Like the young fellow who did the sports car today, I think he said it cost him $500 for all, and that was a lot of money for those days. And the first car he had was an Oldsmobile. I think it was one or two cylinders. And I think the fellow left it in front of the barn or shed where he was living. I think he either drove into the shed or backed it out of it. And he kept it about a week. Some fellow come along, he paid $50 for the car. Some fellow come along and he sold it. He got $150 for the car, plus a two-year-old colt, a horse.
Oh my gosh.
And in 1918, he and a carload of people and another car, two carloads of them, went over to Mount Washington. I think I must have mentioned this the other time, but anyway, they went over and some of the roads weren't much more than a cow path, you know, just two. Took them all day to get there. They just had no signs or anything and hardly to speak of. And they got there, oh, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Time to get ready to leave, it was dark. I guess they hadn't planned to stay, so I decided to drive back. And when they got ready to leave, one of the cars didn't have any lights. The old carbide lights wouldn't work. And my father, I think he had 1917 Chevy. He bought it, a year old. And so he drove back to the lead car, and Lennon hung on the back of his, and the other car followed him. And they drove all night and got into St. Johnsbury in the morning. I think it's so about daylight or 5 o'clock in the morning.
Imagine that. Gosh. One guy a friend of my husband's got his first car. Maybe I told you this.